I don't want you to finish.
Good morning, the tax committee will come to order. I don't know if the, are we set? Okay, great. Thank you. And if I may, I think Representative Tilbury moves the minutes of March 25th, 2009. Is there discussion to the March 25th minutes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. And I would just want to start committee members by saying it is just a delight to have this group with us here today. As you all know, you received the governor's 21st century, is it called the 21st Century Tax Reform Commission's report, I think in February when it became public. And we, in fact, had had this scheduled, and then we were on the floor too long. So we apologize to the commission members that we were not able to hear it then. So now you're back. And so we're really looking forward to having this discussion. This was the governor's tax commission that he appointed last year. He charged them with, I believe, and they can tell us in more detail, making Minnesota have a competitive business climate, but with a revenue-neutral bill. So they actually had to pay for these changes in their bill, in their proposal. And in talking to Mr. Vekich and other members, and then in meeting with the minority members, I talked to people about, would anyone like to introduce this concept as a bill? And so I went ahead and did it to put this bill, this group's recommendations in bill form. So that's been posted on the website. People can see that. And this shows, you know, what the price tag is of all the different items that are being proposed here and then how it would be paid for. So it's important that the committee members will be able to see also how this would actually play out in bill form. So we're just thrilled that you're here. And I think we're going to start with Senator Belanger. And he's first up, and members, if you don't know, Senator Belanger was a tax committee member for how many years, Senator?
26 years, Madam Chair.
26 years, and very knowledgeable in the Minnesota tax system. So with that, let's begin, and welcome. Nice to see you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Governor's Tax Reform Commission was comprised of 15 members, and I know that being a Governor's Commission, that makes us suspect in some of your eyes. But I can assure you that every one of the members was an expert in their particular field of taxation. And there was never any partisanship. We never got into politics. It was all on coming up with a good program for the future. Solving the deficit was not in our charge. And even though I started down that path one day, the commissioner pulled me up short. Told me that my job was not to solve the deficit, it was to come up with a tax plan for the future. We spent 9 months, and we were totally focusing on the future for a way out of Minnesota's problem. In my 26 years, we constantly went from feast to famine, and when we were in the feast, we spent money on new programs. We didn't put it into infrastructure or put it into reserves. And then when we had the famine, then we looked for programs to cut and areas where we could increase taxes. So with that as a background, what we were looking for is to try and get Minnesota to a level playing field and to be a leader in the field of taxation. So the recommendations that we came up with, we went through a lot of discussions, and we really worked all of our recommendations out. What we're recommending to you is a program for future years, and you can go ahead and say that we got this big deficit, so we'll deal with it when we've got a surplus. You do that, you'll never deal with it, because all you'll do is spend money on new programs. So the time to enact a program like this is when you're in a deficit situation. Serving on this commission has been a real education for me because of all these people, these experts that I was able to associate with for 9 months. In my years on the tax committee, we were fat and sassy. I mean, we thought the world was us. And we never looked at what other states were doing, and we never looked at what other countries were doing. And that's what I got to look at on this commission. And so it was a real education for me. So I think with that, I'll turn it over to Chairman Beckett.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Chairman.
Thank you. Well, I'm Mike Beckett, Chair of the Governor's 21st Century Tax Reform Commission. We're glad we're finally here. This has been, as Senator Belanger indicated, a work of love as we've gone through this process to take a look at tax reform for the businesses. I think we've come up with some very good recommendations. Some of them, I'm sure, are controversial in nature. When we began our work, the economic situation was a lot different in June of 08, and we took into consideration all of those things that happened during the time and up to the point in time we made our findings. But we still believe that the important thing is that we needed to come up with good tax policy and something that would be an investment for the future, no matter what the existing deficit may be. Now, how that gets implemented, we understand, is not an easy thing. That's not an easy job for you or for the governor, but we think we have some good policy. Just for a little humor, we were created on Leap Day. We revealed our findings on Friday the 13th. We were at the Senate on Ash Wednesday, and now we're here on April Fool's Day. So there's got to be some humor in all of this in putting together, but it certainly has been an interesting thing. There are some significant things to this. I know that you've had the report for some time. We're going to move quickly through introduction and the findings, and then I'm sure there's going to be a lot of questions in relation to that. First, I'd like to introduce my fellow commissioners that are testifying today. To my left is Dr. John Spry, who is an assistant professor at the University of St. Thomas. And to my right here is Mark Haveman, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. And I have a few members from the commission in the audience I'd like to introduce, so if they just raise their hand. Phil Albert, who is vice president of corporate tax at Medtronic, and Rebecca Paulson, who is a VP of state taxes and a CPA at U.S. Bank. With that, as Senator Belanger indicated, you know, our executive order was to successfully compete with other states and nations for jobs and business investments that promote the long-term economic prosperity of the state and its citizens. I think our recommendations actually do that. It's not a stimulus bill. A stimulus bill really is something that you end up giving somebody money. In this case, is you get to keep what you have and be able to make future investments. And we're not here to erase the deficit. We also took a look at the fact we need to have some principles in order to operate under. And so that was one of the very first thing that we did. Now, these actually embody, you know, the typical things that you would have in tax concepts: transparency, simplicity, and fairness. So obviously, we want, as we looked at our policy, it's got to be inherently competitive. Tax levels of benefits received, what a business pays and what it actually receives, should be equal. They are not. Encourage economic growth, investment, and savings. Reduce administrative costs, and the best thing is resistant to political change. And I'm not sure that will always happen, but we're hoping that when you come up with these recommendations and what we have proposed, that would be the roadmap for the future. So why reform? Dr. Spray?
Madam Chair, members of the commission, to begin with, our charge is to create jobs and payroll, to make Minnesota attractive for investment. And this is particularly important because, as Professor Chris Phelan of the Economics Department at the University of Minnesota says, a worker that works with a bulldozer makes more money than a worker that just works with a shovel. So if we can make Minnesota a more attractive place for investment, the real benefit is actually the people of Minnesota, particularly in workers. We did look, as Senator Belanger said, not just at how our tax code compares nationally, but internationally, and there have been changes. The rest of the world has had some very rapid reductions in statutory corporate tax rates. We have not had that in the U.S. for over two decades.
In addition, our economy has changed and it's become more service-based and less manufacturing-based, and our tax code has not caught up with the move to the service economy. And so we were looking to improve the instance and transparency of our tax system. Business taxes, as we will see in detail, are regressive, hidden taxes on consumers and workers. So one of the things we found was an excellent expert on taxation, William Fox from the University of Tennessee, and his co-authors have done some research on what really has happened in the United States when state corporate income tax rates have been changed. And for example, in the Minnesota experience, in 1986, our corporate tax rate was cut from 12% to 9.5%, and then in 1991, it was increased from 9.5% to 9.8%, which, as you probably have heard, is the third highest statutory rate in the U.S. So, using the tools of econometrics and regression, at a paper presented last November at the National Tax Association's conference, what Professor Fox finds is for the corporate income tax, it has become a very responsive tax base to the tax rate. So I like to use the analogy of a leaky bucket, that we have the private sector, we have the public sector, and what our tax code should be designed to do is to dip into the private sector, raise revenue, carry it across the room, and put it in the public sector for the valuable things that the public sector can produce. Our current tax code, especially the state corporate income tax, is an incredibly leaky bucket. What this means is that you have to dip that leaky bucket into the public sector more and more, carry it over, and then there's the inefficiency, what economists might call the extra burden of taxation from using an outdated form of taxation. And so in our revenue neutral proposal, we propose using a less leaky bucket. And the beauty of tax reform, and I know, Madam Chair, you have a tax reform bill, Senators Rust and Moore have a tax reform bill, and we have our commission report. The beauty of tax reform is if you do it correctly, if you stick to good principles of taxation, you can use a less leaky bucket, which means you don't need to dip as much into the private sector economy to fill up the public sector to the fill here line. So the beauty of tax reform is, even though in the static scoring it appears to be revenue neutral, and it is revenue neutral for the public sector, by using a more efficient type of taxation, you don't need to raise as much revenue. You don't need to burden the public sector, not just with raising the revenue, but with the inefficiencies and the bad decisions and the investments that didn't occur in Minnesota because of our tax code. And that's the beauty. And what is really highlighted here with the through line is that by 2005, a 10% cut in your corporate tax rate as a state will increase your tax base on average 8%. And that is the real experience in the American states from 1985 to 2005. That is a very leaky bucket. Another thing that is important to communicate is that we aren't proposing cutting taxes on business, because business never pays the burden of tax. It's you and I, people, that pay taxes. Businesses mostly pass taxes on to consumers, workers, investors, and using the Minnesota Tax Incidence Study, the research department revenue found that over 90% of any net reduction in corporate tax payments would go to Minnesota consumers and workers. So the corporate tax acts as a hidden tax on consumption of things sold by C-Corps, and it also works to lower wages because you don't get as many bulldozers, or in a high-tech world, you don't have as much information technology per worker, which makes that worker less productive. I should be a two-handed economist, and let me say one good thing about the state corporate income tax. In my research, I could find one good thing about it. It's federally deductible, but that's the same with making an investment with Petters and Madoff. You get to write it off on your taxes. I'll be honest, that's the only real good thing I could find about a state corporate income tax in our research. There's been a lot of discussion already in the public about corporate taxes. We thought it was important to quote Professor Ronald Fisher from Michigan State, and who's an authority, and he says an increase in the state corporate income tax rate is expected to impose burdens on workers, consumers, and owners of immobile capital and land in that state. In other words, the tax increase generally is not exported to non-residents because changes occur in the real income of residents. And that's very important. If you look at the tax incidence study just at the average incidence, it looks like you can export a lot of the corporate income tax. What we're proposing is a rate change. We're proposing eliminating the rate. And one of the reasons we go all the way to zero is when you hit zero, you get to save all of the wasteful administrative costs and compliance costs. And this is the most wasteful tax in terms of Department of Revenue cost per dollar raised of any major tax in Minnesota.
Madam Chair and members, our recommendations fall into three categories. One, reducing the tax burden, increasing transparency, and improving investments. And we'll go through each one of those for you now. The recommendations, we have five of those. One is repeal the corporate income tax and franchise tax, replace the capital equipment sales tax refund with an upfront exemption, conform the federal write-offs for business assets, extend the capital equipment exemption to services, and exempt 20% of pass-through income. So we'll go through each one of these separately, and Dr. Spy is going to do repeal corporate tax.
Okay. A huge question. Who benefits from repealing the corporate income tax? We think this is a very bold proposal. We want our economy to be more like the Irish economy, when they had a dramatic reduction in corporate tax rates a few decades ago and had dramatic growth. British Columbia and Alberta are other examples of places that have moved with pretty dramatic reductions. I got to say, Minnesota going from 12% to 9.5% in 1986, that was followed by a pretty nice period of economic growth for the state of Minnesota. But who benefits? Again, you've heard this from Dr. Wilson. Kind of ignore that first decile, because there's some technical measurement errors, but the benefit actually is disproportionately for people in the lower and middle tax brackets, and the benefit of repealing corporate income tax is actually smallest for the top 10% of the population decile. And I think the reason is, many of you may believe we don't tax clothing, but we don't tax the sale of food in Minnesota. What we do, if you read the statute for the state corporate income tax, it is a heavily Minnesota sales apportioned tax, and there is not a list of exclusions. So if you're a Minnesota C corp and you sell cigarettes, you sell insulin, you sell medical devices, you sell prescription drugs, you sell grocery food, you sell clothing to Minnesotans, then in the formula in the code itself, and I hope the media is hearing this because this is a nice scoop. In the code itself, as we currently have it, we tax the sale of food. We tax the sale of clothing. But since we call it the corporate income tax, it's not widely known that since 1933, we have been putting a tax on grocery store food. And that's one of the reasons we are proposing repealing the corporate income tax. We believe the research and our website has a mountain of research on the negative economic effects of state corporate income taxes. There's a near consensus among economists, which never really happens, that state corporate income taxes are a bad policy. So for economic growth, enacting our reform is good, but it also repeals a hidden tax. And I think it is far preferable to be honest and transparent. And if you're going to have a tax on additional services or goods, have it be on the register receipt and not hide it in a complicated sales apportionment formula.
Rebecca, replacing the capital equipment sales tax refund with upfront. This really doesn't make a lot of sense. We're talking about an average of $220 million of refunds given every year, and about 5% is left on the table. Think about, in today's economy, that kind of cash available to businesses. If they're originally going to get it back, this would be best just to have an upfront exemption. And I think the number of bills that now have been presented are clearly saying that this is the direction that we want to go. Conforming the federal write-offs with for business taxes. Minnesota presently, under, as we refer to, Section 179 depreciation write-off, is capped at $25,000. The federal is $250,000, and we're recommending that we immediately move to the federal conformity as going forward. Again, this is a big factor for small businesses. Large businesses, of course, is not as big a factor, but for a small business today, and of course we're looking for people to continue to invest in their business, this would have a huge impact on them. Extend the capital equipment exemption to businesses that provide services subject to sales tax. For those of you that have been here for a while, we refer to the 1987 sales tax exemption for service businesses. We're recommending that that also be repealed, but extended to other service businesses who actually buy capital equipment that use it in their business. For example, that might be a doctor, that might be a dentist, and any other type of service business. Ancillary types of products that were not used directly to provide a service would not be included in our recommendation. And the last is exempt 20% of pass-through income from taxation. We're recommending this for pass-through organizations, subchapter S corporations, limited liability corporations, and partnerships. As you all know, that at the end of the year, they get a K-1, and hopefully it has income on it. And with that, we're recommending that 20% off of the top be exempted from personal income tax on the flow-through. We all know that Minnesota right now top rate is 7.85%, which is the 11th highest in the nation. With this recommendation, the scoring, as we understand it, would drop it to 6.28%, which would end up being the 23rd highest in the nation. Our next series of recommendations goes to transparency, and Commissioner Haven will take that.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Mark Haven. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. I should note at the start here that my participation on the commission was as an individual, and what my testimony does not necessarily reflect the position of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. However, if the commission would like to, or the committee would like to hear from the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, more than welcome to get somebody to come before you on this. Transparency, we believe, is obviously a critical issue in tax systems. The recommendations that we have in this area are a little more administrative and technical in nature, but we feel no less important. The first one, as you see, is require a biennial benefits received report on Minnesota business taxation. We know that this committee takes the concept of tax incidents and the tax incident study very seriously, as it should. The tax policy implications of tax incidents are, as Dr. Spry has discussed earlier, that people pay taxes, and therefore the benefits received principle is really the fundamental rationale for taxing business. And we believe that a benefits received report would help frame the debate on the appropriate level of business taxation in Minnesota. If you looked at our report, you saw that it's a study done by the Council on State Taxation based on a methodology developed by the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank was sort of a cornerstone for this issue of calibrating the right level of business taxation in the state of Minnesota. And obviously there's going to be a lot of debate about the allocation systems that were used for spending in terms of who gets the benefit. Is it go to households? Does it go to businesses? Does it go to both? And how is all that apportioned? Certainly, that belongs as part of the debate in developing a biennial tax, a biennial benefit study like this. That shouldn't stop us from undertaking this. We have debates over whether per capita or per $1,001 basis is the appropriate way to look at tax levels in the state. We can fully anticipate those same sorts of discussions would be part of this study in having different approaches to deriving this. But the big issue is that we feel that this can be an important complement to the incident study, the price of government study, and many other studies that the state does in helping us introduce some objective analysis into what has typically been an exceptionally subjective debate. The other areas that involve improvements to the property tax system, I'd like to head to the last one first, and that is converting tax capacity rates to more common millage rates, in essence scrapping the tax capacity system that we have here in the state of Minnesota. We are the only state in the nation that essentially manufactures an entirely new property tax base. And if that doesn't add enough complexity, the issue behind that is it's really unnecessary. It doesn't need to be done. You can use assessment ratios to get where you want to go with a tax capacity system without that additional level of complexity. And from a transparency standpoint, it helps, but also from a potential business siting standpoint, it also helps. It's interesting to look at how property tax rates are advertised in Minnesota compared to other states. Every other state that's based on a mill system and translates that into a percentage system will have property tax rates. If you look at Brookings, South Dakota, for example, you know, Chamber of Commerce website, you'll see property tax rates 2.3%, 2.4%. Same with Iowa, same with Wisconsin. Suddenly in Minnesota, you find tax rates like in Albert Lea for 168% or something of that nature. Now, obviously, these are not effective tax rates, but there is, I think, a legitimate advertising issue. Why unnecessarily punish ourselves with these tax rates based on a tax capacity system that make us look hopelessly uncompetitive and force people who are not familiar with our tax system and all its complexity to drill down and figure out what the true story is? And again, an assessment limit system gets you where you want to go without this additional level of complexity. The other two areas we feel it's important to work towards simplification of the property tax system, a fewer classes. Our report suggests four. And also continuing on with a repeal of a limited market value. We're almost there, and making sure that that stays in place would be an important thing to do, benefiting both households and businesses in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Commissioner. Our last set of recommendations regarding promoting investment. The first one is to overhaul the R&D tax credit. It's interesting that Minnesota was the first state to adopt R&D credit in 1982, subsequent to the federal recognition of R&D credit. Today, our tiered 5% / 2% tiered R&D is the lowest, amongst the lowest in the nation. So we're recommending some substantial recommendations here. One, we're also recommending that this be extended to R&D credits, be extended to pass through entities. In many respects, a lot of R&D is done through these types of entities, and this would promote a lot more investment and in R&D in Minnesota. We're recommending that the rate be increased to 10%, and also that the R&D credits become refundable. In many cases, in startups of this type, you run a loss in a flow-through entity and potentially in a C corporation also. This is, again, making it refundable, not at a huge cost overall, but promoting additional R&D. As you take a look at what has had, look as where we're at on public R&D, especially with the University of Minnesota, we're down about half from where we were 10, 15 years ago. This is something that we need to continue promoting the state. High-paying jobs,
means about 70% of the dollars go into compensation, so this will create more jobs. Minnesota has always been a leader in this area, and this is a nice way of being able to put it back into a leader in the country. The second, most of you are familiar with, an act, the Small Business Investment Act. The act as proposed recommends $100 million. We're recommending that this be authorized at $200 million. The money will come from insurance companies. They would, our recommendation is that they would receive a 20% credit per year against their premium tax. As you know, they do not pay an income tax, up to a maximum of 80%. But this would not start until 4 years subsequent to the enactment of the bill. So we'd have 4 years of being able to put $200 million into this economy to grow businesses just at the level they're ready to emerge. This is very difficult money money to get. I've spent 25 years of my career in this area, investment banking and raising money. This type of money is difficult to get. And if we have someone that is willing to step up to put this kind of money into it, I think this is something we should very seriously consider. The second is to enact an early stage investment tax credit. This refers mostly more to, that you're familiar with, angel investors. These are where you get the $100,000 types of investment. And again, if we think the other is difficult to get, at the $100,000 level, again, it's very difficult to get. I professionally have lived in this area. I've also personally been an angel investor. And when you get to this level, it's very difficult to get. This is the kind of investment money that we really want to get start a business, mostly technology, medical fields, where this this is. So 30% tax credit. The credits would be capped at $15 million per year. We'd convert that to investment cash of about $50 million. Angel investors bring additional things to the table. Resources, their business acumen, and also networking, you know, to get these kinds of businesses going. So between the two of these, you're talking about investing in Minnesota economy, and it has to be businesses that are based here, that actually have employees here, $250 million. That is a lot of money. It would be based on where our economy is right now. This would be very, very helpful. And the last is to encourage low-income entrepreneurship and business creation loans. This is, we recommend establishing a small enterprise loan guarantee program and also expand the current Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota initiative. Both of these programs are really designed to provide gap financing for those geographic areas with high poverty and high unemployment rates. The CellGap Small Enterprise Loan Program would guarantee loans to low-income households for the purposes of starting a business. And I have seen this program work in St. Paul. There's a couple of banks that are involved in this. And it's interesting to watch at very low numbers for those entrepreneurs, especially immigrants that are coming to this country. Just a little bit of gap financing will get them to the next level. So, Madam Chair and members, that concludes our total recommendations. But there is, as we look at all of this, is there any consensus for this type of reform? Dr. Spratton.
Okay. I mentioned earlier that within the economics profession, state corporate income taxes have a very bad reputation. Art Roenick from the Federal Reserve Bank says any time is a good time to fix a bad policy. Business taxes are inefficient, period. If you go back to the House research briefing on the Minnesota tax code on your website from January, there's a statement there that tax theorists can't find a lot good to say about corporate income taxes. And the Pew Center in Governing Magazine said that obsolete state taxes are not only not producing the revenue states need, those tax systems are failing to keep up with the dramatic shifts in the U.S. economy. They are a drag on economic growth. And so we are very focused while being revenue neutral
and filling up the public sector bucket using a less leaky bucket, so you don't have to dip and put such a tax burden on the private sector. And that means more jobs, that means better prices for consumers, and prosperity.
With all of that, we have to pay for the reform. We've talked about reducing tax burdens, we've talked about increasing transparency, and then we've also talked about promoting investment. We all understand that this needs to be paid for. That was one of our charges from the governor. And obviously, part of this reforms have impacts, budget impacts. Not an easy time to come in front of you to talk about these kinds of reforms and this expense. However, this is an investment in the future, and therefore we're strongly recommending that you embrace financing reforms. Should obviously be fair and transparent. And taxing personal consumption rather than income promotes savings, investment, and capital formation, and reforms need not be regressive. So with that, our recommendations are in two areas. One is to increase the excise tax on cigarettes. In our report, you can see there's a recommendation at $1, which brings in about $148 million, or 50 cents, which brings in, I believe, around $98 million. And the last is to extend the state sales tax base to a broader range of consumer products and consumer services. And I would like to direct you to page 27 of the report, because I'm going to quote from it because I want to make sure that I'm perfectly clear as to what the commission is not recommending. And we are also not recommending winners or losers or picking specific items for this. But let me quote from page 27. Says, the commission is not recommending specific consumer goods or consumer services to be taxed. As a general guideline, however, it would be best to avoid extending the sales tax to products that carry significant regressivity concerns, such as food or residential heating fuels, without a corresponding income tax credit targeted at lower income taxpayers, or to those items already exposed to excise or wholesale taxes, such as motor fuels and prescription drugs. Purchases of food or services by businesses should generally be exempt from sales tax, as in the case of capital equipment, to the extent the goods and services represent business inputs and contribute to the final goods or services. So in conclusion, Madam Chair, and members I've indicated before, some tough decisions that are in front of you, in front of the governor to make. But I love the Churchill comment. Is it a pessimist is someone who finds the difficulties in every opportunity, and an optimist finds the opportunities in every difficulty. And obviously we have a number of difficulties, and there are lots of opportunities here. And we strongly recommend that you embrace and also enact all of our recommendations, because we do believe that this will put Minnesota in a very highly competitive state. It will promote savings, it will promote investment, and it will also create jobs. So, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and we will be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Questions from members? Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't believe there wasn't a list already. Maybe for Professor Spry, the one thing that we have heard about, and the one thing that's been a concern to me and well, actually many committee members here, is the S-Corps, the LLPs, and the LLCs. You know, with our 9.8 rate, we've heard from a number of testifiers here, from a number of chamber dinners or luncheons I've been at, that because we have that higher corporate rate, we have a larger number of folks that, rather than go to the corporate side, stay in the S's, the LLPs, and LLCs, because it's easier to balance your tax burden that way. And I'm wondering if you could just address a little bit of that with us, what you saw in comparative taxation in states around us, or, you know, as you go across the country, how we have maybe a higher level, or how that our higher corporate rate forces people into that sort of situation.
Thank you, Representative Zellers, and Professor Spry. If you could also explain that the corporate tax base is much more narrow in Minnesota than most of these states. So when we fall into the rate trap, it kind of skews the data. Professor Fry.
Madam Chair, Representative Zeller, first, it's important as a general principle of taxation, the leakiness of the bucket, the extra burden you pay beyond the taxes collected, increases with the square of the tax rate. So we are starting off with a 35% federal tax rate, and when you take into account federal deductibility, our 9.8% rate gets added onto the 35% rate. So it's both a combination that's common across the United States, that since we have a very high, as a country, we have the second highest statutory corporate tax rate in the world, behind Japan. It's not just in the U.S., but many businesses remain as pass-throughs, and Professor Ken Judd of Stanford University has pointed out in his research how damaging this is. Because if you have a good company, you're growing, you're doing something new, the tax code is so penalizing. It's not really confiscatory, but it's a 41.4% statutory rate. You would do anything you could to remain a pass-through, but the thing that will push you into being a C-Corp is if you're like a Google or YouTube. If you want to go public, what you can't be is you have to become a C-Corp if you're going to have lots of owners and be traded publicly. So we really stunt the growth, nationally and particularly in Minnesota, of some of our most dynamic companies, because one of the distortions from the tax code is we really discourage you from going public and becoming a C-code. It's important that with the statutory rate, we take into account, in fact, in a lot of ways, the statutory rate isn't telling the whole picture, because the corporate tax is part of a system of double taxation, quadruple taxation, because you have federal and state corporate tax. Then, when the dividend is paid, or there's a capital gains, you have federal and state personal tax. So when you hear the 41.4%, and that's the third highest corporate tax rate in the world, that makes it sound too good. Because what you have left over, the other approximately 62%, you may be paying 28% of that when you get a dividend. So that double taxation, federal and state, really discourages you from using the corporate form. This is one of the reasons why the corporate base is shrinking. In terms of the broadness of the base, the federal government does a lot of setting the broadness of our base. And an issue that's a concern to me with the federal tax code that addresses the chair's point is the expensing rules. And this gets very arcane. But if we aren't a state with a lot of oil pipeline, the oil pipeline, for example, gets a really favorable depreciation schedule, and some other things like industrial structures that I really would like to have in Minnesota get a very unfavorable depreciation schedule. And as a commission, we looked, and as a state, you just can't set up your own depreciation schedules. It would make an administrative nightmare even worse. So there's only, I think, a fairly limited room to try to look at broadening the base at the state level. A lot of the base broadening that could occur really would have to be done federally in our analysis.
Okay, so left on broad, we now have seven people behind you, so we want to go quick questions, quick
first
answers, or we're not going to get through them. Left on Zeller.
Well, no, it's just the first time I got to be first.
Yeah. Right? But I do want to just follow up on that, just to understand the report. You're talking about the S-corporations, and so our C-corps pay 9.8, and why would you be an S-corp? Because you only pay 7.85. So that's pretty obvious. Everyone gets that. But if I understand the proposals here correctly, we would have those folks pay 6.28. So it would be a tax cut on individuals who, as you know, we know in our Minnesota Tax Incidents Report, those folks are already kind of getting a better deal than everyone else. So I think that one's a little harder for members to get their heads around. I mean, it's, You know, that F courts are at 7.85, and this would be a tax cut to the wealthiest Minnesotans. Rep. Gonzalez.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and we won't bring them into our...
Well, no, just the proposal, though.
Right, no,
so,
but
I want you to know that, unless they want to refute me here, a 20% cut to the S-Corp is, instead of a 7.85 top rate, it's a 6.28. So that's lower than our second bracket of income.
I think the refuting...
So represents...
refuting them that is the good deal part.
Rep. Gonzalez.
No.
Let's ask the commission to tell us if the 6.28 is wrong. Is that correct?
No, 6.28 is right. And in terms of leakiness of the bucket, you'll hear economists often say this. I think, Madam Chair, you often have said broad and low is better than narrow. The other part of the discussion is how leaky is the bucket, how elastic is the tax base. And for time, I'll just refer you to page 19. But if you look at the research by Bob Carroll, who's a more conservative economist, or by Emmanuel Sez, who's a more liberal economist, there's a lot of evidence that people in the tax bracket the chair was discussing, and even more specifically, pass-through corporations, S-Corps, LLCs, and your partnerships, that their tax base, how much taxable income they have, is very responsive to the marginal tax rate that they face. And so while it's true, the tax instance study makes the assumption that all of the burden of any pass-through tax is felt exclusively by the owners of the pass-through corporation. I'm somebody that, as an economist, I lost my job in the last recession, and I would argue that some of the benefit of more investment and more tax base, more economic activity by pass-through entities would not just go to the people that own the pass-throughs, but it would be the people that work there. And I'll be honest, if I didn't think that that burden wasn't also passed on to the workers, I wouldn't be as in favor of the proposal. But I am in favor of the proposal because I think it's not just the C-Corp world, but it's the general business world. We want more incentives for investment because I don't want anybody else to go through what I went through where you're looking for a job in a recession.
Okay, Rep. Gonzalez.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I won't get into the details, but a good deal, you know, when we're talking about taxation to job providers, I don't know that when we're looking at a down economy, as we've been discussed around here many times, the taxation question, I don't think how much or how little less you pay in taxes is the good deal part of it. I think we're talking about taxing our job providers. And if you pay more in taxes, you're going to have less for your job, for your business, for your, you know, expansion, your R&D credit, whatever it is. Now, I just don't think that... we'll go back to the part. I don't think bringing that the discussion into who the indices study and who pays more and who pays less, because that's on income only. It's not on the overall tax burden. So, that's our fight we've had here for many months, and I'm sure we're going to have. But the point I'm trying to make is when we're adding these taxes and we're talking about our corporate tax is so high that it's forcing people to stay in that bracket where, and under this proposal, I'll let these gentlemen defend it. It's not that you're getting a better deal. You may have a little bit lower rate, but you're still not going to have the better deal in this. So I'll let others ask questions, Madam Chair.
Rep. Gonzalez, this is being flowed through the individual income tax. When we're talking about S-Corp, that's exactly how the tax is paid. It's not paid through the individual income tax.
But it's not a great deal that they're getting here.
We don't want to get too sidetracked here, but I do want to say, I mean, if I understand the proposal correctly, and I don't want to get it wrong here, if you have, let's take two people earn $150,000 a year. One works for a company, and they earn $150,000 a year. They're a VP of something in some company. If you're the owner of that company and you earn $150,000, you get a tax cut from 7.85 to 6.28. But if you have identical income, you're not an owner. You don't get the tax cut. So I think that's what this proposal is putting forward. So we just need to be clear on how it would play, because the owners versus the income is a different deal. So we're even competing within the top bracket. So, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, our proposal is only on the pass-through income. It is not on the wage income or the investment income. So in your example there, both individuals for most of their income would be in the same rate, because I'm not one of the CPAs, but I think our CPAs would tell us that you just can't declare it all pass-through income. You have to pay yourself a reasonable wage. So it's that business, it's only that business pass-through, and it's really trying to promote the growth of investment for job creation.
Thank you. Repson Gardner, Solver, Reinert, Downey, Les, Fraud, Coles, Loon, Dietrich. Repson Gardner. Repson Gardner.
Well, we should order out lunch now, Madam Chair. I had two questions, if you'll humor me. I'm just trying to think about the interconnections of some of the proposals. And I want to thank you for thinking big. I don't know if I agree with everything in here, but this is the year to do it. And also thank you for acknowledging that our immigrant communities are assets in Minnesota. That often doesn't come across in other areas. But on the issue of the S-Corps, if we repeal the corporate franchise tax to zero, would not we see people who are S-Corps go, this is all, it's just like a good deal, let's go to the zero tax rate, and then the individual income tax rate just becomes an issue about wealth, at least at the higher brackets, and so you don't have to worry about negatively impacting investment capital, you're just talking about wealth.
Right.
So why do you need to do both, I guess?
Chairman Beckett.
Madam Chair and Representative Gardner, I'm going to have a comment, I'm sure Dr. Spy is also. I don't think you're going to see an automatic shift from an S-Corp LLC to a C-Corporation for one specific reason. Under the federal code, there's if you go back to a C-Corp, you're going to have built-in gain, which you end up getting a double taxation. Most small corporations are going to end up being sold at some point in time, unless they're really building to a large company eventually to go to a C-Corp, go public. So I don't see a big switch for that. The federal tax impact on that is way too high, and it would follow through on Minnesota also.
And then
my
second question is, we've talked a little bit about the R&D credit. I'm in the North Metro, where we have a lot of medical device activity going on. And I've been trying to get someone to answer this for months, and I never get an answer. What do you think if we were able to target R&D credits, I know you said you're not going to target winners and losers, but if we were going to identify budding clusters of industries to say, here's the next big thing, do you know where we'd be at? I mean, a lot of our traditional legacy industries have either faded away or been absorbed into other things or seeing global competition, and so we're looking for new things, the next Medtronic, the next 3M, and if we were to target R&D grants, maybe, not just credits, but focus on individual things and absorb higher education and all the assets we have, you know, where would we do that?
Chairman Beck.
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, if I knew that, would be like winning the lottery, if I knew specifically where it was going. I want to be clear, we're not targeting specific R&D credits. It's broad. There are no targets to this. The only thing that we're not targeting is on the sales tax broad base. Obviously, we still have a budding industry in healthcare, the medical care area, especially the devices, as well as technology. Those are the big areas that I continue to see for investment purposes. However, I can tell you that the company that I now run, we have two plants in China. It is now cheaper because of the exchange rate for us to manufacture here. So in addition to that, we may see manufacturing come back, which I would personally like to see manufacturing come back as be a part of a vibrant Minnesota community as well as the U.S. economy.
And I want to thank Representative Reinert and Coles, who've removed their names from the list because we want to get through the rest of the list, and we still want to see the bill and the revenue estimate all before we adjourn. So, Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, mine will be very quick. Congratulations, Mr. Beckett. It's good to have an Iron Ranger be a very successful business person. And I think a graduate of Itasca Community College, too, right?
Skipping, unfortunately, Representative.
Well,
that's the same thing.
Here I thought it was my taxpayer that helped, property taxpayer that helped support the Itasca Community College. In fact, it was giving taxpayers that gave all of us a good education. At some
yes, they did.
Point. But my question is, if the recommendations of the Governor's Commission were big, bold, and reform, and Why was it within 15 seconds that the governor rejected all these?
Chairman.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I think put it in context, I think the governor's representative said that the governor didn't embrace the broadening of the sales tax base.
Representative Solberg. My question is, since the charge was to be revenue neutral, what would the other revenue neutral part be from the administration? Or do you have some recommendations other than broadening the sales tax as a revenue neutral?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, we are not specifically recommending specific as a part of this. As it relates to the governor embracing or not embracing the broadening of the sales tax, one of the things that we were not encumbered by were the budget constraints. And as you can see, I think he has embraced probably 60 to 70% of our recommendations as a part of that. And as part of his budget, I haven't gone through in detail. He pays for it. But
Mr. Chair, I thought that the charge that you heard right at the very beginning was the revenue neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that if you have a tax break or decrease for somebody, there has to be a way to fill up that bucket.
Yes.
And the increases that I've seen or the filling up has been mostly on broadening of the sales tax with, I noticed also some exemptions like don't have businesses have sales tax for services between businesses tax, but only for consumption. That's kind of interesting. I'm just kind of curious though, if that's the only recommendation, then are there other alternatives that you consider to be able to fill it up? Or is it just say, well, we'll broaden the sales tax and let everyone else decide who that might be? Are there other thinking outside of the box ways of making this revenue neutral?
Chairman Beck.
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, we did take a look at a number of other areas, but that really ended up, if we went to other areas specifically, which we would not recommend increasing individual income tax rates, et cetera, because that just puts us in a continued non-competitive basis. You all know that, you know, in the exemption book, there are several billions of dollars of exempted items on the sales tax and consumer base. And that's really when you're talking about how to really tax would be on the consumer consumption basis. So when we looked at what was available, clearly the excise tax on cigarettes, and it's clear the impact that it's had from the last one that was passed and it continues going forward. That adds $2 billion of additional medical costs to business. That could be additional savings. That could be passed on to workers. So when we looked at this, our recommendation was if it's good tax policy and we broaden it to consumer base, that would be the place to go. Where the governor goes on this, that was not a discussion we had with him. We would come up with the best policy, revenue neutral, because we knew there were enough dollars inside of the exempted sales tax consumer base to cover this.
Hey, Representative, are you done? We have six more questions, and we still want to get to see what the bill does. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll hold off on a comment and just ask the question, and that is, it seems to me that there's a lot in here for early stage investment and the encouragement of investment to occur. And then what we experience a lot in Minnesota now is that as a startup venture matures and actually starts to scale and goes into production, if you will, our cost is too high and we start losing those businesses. We're a reasonably attractive place, and with this, it would be even more attractive to actually start and launch the business. So without trying to compete for highly commoditized manufacturing that we're never going to win at, what in this proposal actually gives businesses more opportunity to grow and scale in Minnesota and to keep their production in their other facilities here as they grow out of that entrepreneurial stage?
Chairman Beck.
Madam Chair and Representative Downey, and I'm sure my colleagues have some comments also. I think when you take a look at, I know there's been a lot of discussion around the fact that Minnesota has the third highest statutory rate in the world. And I understand effective rates and we get all of that.
But first of all, the tracking business in Minnesota is that sometimes we don't know what we're losing just because of the factors of the high advertised rate, real estate taxes, et cetera. That's number one. Number two, with our proposals, the elimination of corporate income tax. We still know that you and I pay the taxes. That's cash flow. That business, that amount of dollars available to put back into their businesses, capital savings, capital investment, employees. The second part of this, on the 20%, as it relates to flow-throughs, we have a lot more flow-throughs than we have C corporations. And that, again, will involve and leave a lot more cash flow on the table. So I look at these things very simply. It's all about cash. If you don't have the cash, you cannot invest. If you don't have the cash, you cannot hire employees. So this is not a stimulus package. This is a long-term investment package that really keeps businesses here, puts us in a highly competitive position probably anywhere in the country. The day I believe that that this body passes the repeal of the corporate income tax and et cetera, that will put us on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. People will start taking a look at it seriously. And you also add to that R&D credit, which has been a big part of what we should be doing in Minnesota. We were the leaders, 1982. Now we're some of the lowest in the country. It doesn't make sense to me.
Dr. Stein?
I would just point to the Irish example. The other states that don't have a corporate income tax right now are Nevada, which is a gambling economy, Wyoming, which is a mineral economy, and South Dakota, which is our neighbor but has largely a farming economy. If you were to combine our educated workforce, an international airport, our large metro area, our very successful small towns, and we had the lowest corporate tax rate in the U.S., then for all those decisions where companies are deciding, we've got to be in the U.S., but where do we go? We become very attractive. We are not doing a good job right now at attracting foreign direct investment to Minnesota, and the research we cite in our report shows that foreign direct investment is highly sensitive to your corporate tax rate. And I would love to see new foreign investment. I'd love to see domestic investment, period, for jobs.
Thank you. Representative Downing, were you done?
No, thank you.
Okay. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To what extent, any of the testifiers, did your analysis take into consideration the GAO report from June? And if you're not familiar with that, I'm assuming you are.
And you're asking Professor Spry or Chairman Beckett?
Any of them, but let's go with Professor Spry.
Okay.
Please. Madam Chair, Representative Lush, I am familiar with that report. One of the huge problems that economists have with corporate taxes in general is that they really reward debt. So if you run your business the way, say, Lehman Brothers was run. Now, Lehman Brothers used a 38-to-1 debt-to-equity ratio. You're rewarded under the corporate income tax compared to a company that does the exact same thing but doesn't teeter near bankruptcy all the time because they're more conservative in their corporate financing decisions. So the GAO report shows that a number of corporations have no federal corporate tax liability in a particular year. And, again, I was talking about the federal depreciation rules. If you do a lot of investment in oil pipelines, which receives favorable depreciation, or auto tracks, waste tracks, got a spatial provision in the TARP bill last year, that auto tracks got more favorable depreciation. It was one of these things that was a sweetener on the Christmas tree. If you are an auto track, you got a favorable depreciation passed, and then instead of maybe being more robust to an economic downturn and using equity finance, you use debt finance. That's really rewarded by the corporate tax code, and to me, that is, to say it mildly, a poor tax policy.
No further questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wondered if either Chairman Beckett or any of the other testifiers could talk a little bit more about the notion, and I'm very interested in this concept, of measuring benefits received for taxes levied. And I know we talk a lot about tax fairness and progressivity and regressivity in both individual and then talking about corporate rates. But how do we measure that accurately? And I think it does bear discussion with regards to relationships between taxes people pay and what they receive for the value of that investment.
Chairman Beckett.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Haven lands that.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Commissioner,
just Representative Loon over there.
Thank you.
I'm looking to find her, but there she is. We're all, there's a lot of new faces this year, so it's hard to learn who everyone is. So yeah.
The methodology that we cite in our report that we use is based on work done at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago and adopted by the Council of State Taxation. Basically, it's rather simple what they do. They look at the sum of business taxation, which includes property taxes, general sales taxes on business inputs, corporate income tax, et cetera, et cetera. And then they look at the expenditure side of the equation. They look at state and local expenditures by category through census data. They subtract intergovernmental transfers, so it truly is sort of a state and local tax delivery issue. They subtract user charges as well to come up with sort of tax-funded expenditures, which is the denominator of the benefits received ratio, taxes to benefits received. Then the tricky part is, of course, parsing this pool of expenditures accordingly. And just to give you an idea of how this particular approach works, the Federal Reserve and cost approach puts the following in household categories: libraries, housing, community development, parks and recreation, fish and forestry, health, hospital, veteran services, welfare, unemployment insurance. In the business category, natural resources, not otherwise classified, water transport, you have a whole host of shared services, which are basically split 50-50, sewage, solid waste management, judicial, fire protection, police, et cetera, right on down the line. Then a series of prorated, which are sort of, you know, apportioned at some percentage basis. And that includes, in the cost study, the big kahuna, public education, which they allocate 25% to business in that approach. The cost study, although a more recent study has just come out, the one that we examined placed Minnesota 8th worst in the nation on a benefits received ratio among all 50 states. I believe it was 20% higher than the national average. The reason for that is essentially Minnesota's historical higher level of spending on health and human service programs compared to the national average. If you look historically at Minnesota spending, about 10, 15 years ago, we were consistently at or oftentimes above the national average in most of these expenditure categories. Over time, we have slipped in most of those areas to, in many cases, below average, except for one area. We were 35% above the national average on a per capita or per $1,000 income basis, doesn't make any difference, on health and human services 10 years ago, and we're still there now. Now, that's not to say we haven't received significant benefits from that spending, but the point is there may be an opportunity cost associated with that spending, and that is a crowding out of expenditures that may directly benefit business productivity.
Okay, so we're going to do three more questions in 3 more minutes. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to commend the Commission for the work that they have done, and I look at these points, and I actually just wish we could do all of them. It's very frustrating that we can't, but then reality sets in. And so I just want to encourage you to continue doing your work. And the one piece that I would really like to point out is the encourage promoting investment. The fourth bullet, encouraging low-income entrepreneurship. A couple of those, I do wonder if it is truly the role of government to do all four of those, and if it is, to what extent, and that we can't afford to do all of it. And so how can we partnership with other entities? And then more specifically, the one on encouraging low-income entrepreneurship. I think it's incumbent on our community education, community schools, four-year institutions, to help teach kids and and young people on how to be entrepreneurs and give them the skills and the tools and the structures so that they feel that they can be more of the risk takers. So I'm going to stop with there, but I would just like to say that I hope that you will continue your work and work with other public entities and private to achieve those goals, because they are very worthy. Thank you.
Thank you, Russ and Pete Chicken, and I think they've heard the challenge. So we appreciate that. We're going to go to Russ and Murphy, then Rukavina, then we want to see the bill. Russ and Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to thank the commission for coming forward with an idea and a way to pay for it. I think that's, you know, brave and smart. I live in a part of St. Paul that has lots of retail and lots of small businesses. My family's, my husband actually started a small business 30 years ago, struggling through this economy, but they're still in business. And I think Minnesotans and the legislature really love small businesses. We have sort of a level fair with the idea of that maverick entrepreneurship. And they are really important to our economy. And as I look at these proposals and as I shop these around, I don't see a lot here that is going to help establish small businesses, right? I think, you know, we're targeting toward maybe bringing some new R&D in, and I think that's good. And, you know, the idea about an exemption on capital equipment may or may not be helpful to some small businesses that are already in place, so I don't think it's really got a direct relationship to job creation. So I'm wondering if there were other ideas that the commission had that were more tailored to already established small businesses.
Chairman.
Madam Chair, I think if you go through and look at a couple of items there, the SBIA Act, as well as the Angel Investment Tax Credit, I think that will have a huge impact. That's $50 million, just in the Angel Investment Tax, that's $50 million injected into the economy for an overall credit. The SBIA Act, it determines what you define a small business. But the SBIA Act will take into effect a number of small businesses that are ready to emerge. It's really getting the community, investment community, to start investing in small businesses. And that's why I think some of the other things that we recommended with the SELGP and the gap financing is a part of that. And in addition to that, cash flow on the 20%, even though there's discussion, there are a number of small businesses that and people that at the 20% level would benefit from would leave cash flow back into business.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Rukavina.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and members. And I have often proclaimed to be probably one of the dumbest people at the Capitol, but I'm smart enough to know that when you put, it looks like 13 business people on a committee to figure out what to do with taxes, it's going to come out with cut business taxes. In fact, I think the closest person we got to a Democrat on this commission is former Senator Belanger. So, you know, or maybe a Republican moderate ranger. But
I crossed the aisle, Tommy?
Yes, so you always did. But, you know, you can talk about facts and figures all you want, what may happen, but I'm looking at this printout I've been carrying around in my pocket, Mr. Vekic, from Deed Figures. And, you know, back in 1999 and 2000, we cut income tax for everyone. But in fact, I believe about $400 million of the $900 million a year we cut in income tax went to the top 4% of the richest people in Minnesota, who would be, I think, a lot of the people who benefit from your 20% pass-through here. But the point being this, members, if you look at what happened in job growth, the job growth was much smaller every year than when the professor talked about former Governor Carlson raising the corporate income tax up from 9.5% to 9.8% in 91. And in 92, we had 40,000 new jobs. In 93, 50,000. In 90, 80,000. I'm talking cumulative, not cumulative, but actual number of job increases in Minnesota versus in the 30s and down to minus 6,000 jobs by 2002 after we cut first income tax, most of which went to the wealthiest Minnesotans. So, you know, I'm just a dummy, but, you know, I'm smart enough to know that if there's ever a nuclear war, Professor, or Mr. Vekic, or the head of the taxpayers' week, or if the whole global economy goes to hell, I want to be with the guy driving the dozer and none of you people, because I know he'll keep thriving and existing somehow. So, you know, that's what happens. You're hammering, I think unfairly, with sales tax increases and cigarette tax increases, the very people who are right now carrying an unfair disproportionate share of their income. So.
Okay, and I think
I'm just a dummy, that's my comment.
Representative Rukavina meant the Minnesota Taxpayers Association.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
We got that. He knows. Okay, so let's have a quick response. We have 5 minutes to see the bill now, member. So it's really unfortunate here, so please.
A couple of comments. Interesting statistics about, let me give you some other factoids. Minnesota workers reaching 62 will jump 20% 2009. 50s and 60s are fastest growing in the segment from 2008 to 2020. 18 to 24 year olds entering the workforce will decline over the next 12 years. That comes directly from the data that you're getting. So there may have been an increase, and there may have been a cut for personal income taxes, et cetera, but let me share with you, Representative, that I believe that this is an investment going into the future, because we've got to create more jobs. We have to get much more productivity in this. As we are aging at an exponential level, and our millennials are not growing here, we've got to start getting more jobs here. We have to get more investment in Minnesota, and that really is, when you take a look at our recommendations, I believe, this puts us in a great position for investment, more jobs, and more people building bulldozers as well as those doing research at the University of Minnesota.
Okay, Dr. Wilson, can you join us at the table? We have now 3 minutes to have everybody see what this actually all costs and what the bill does. So I apologize, but this is the most important part to the tax committee. Tax committees actually have to find the money to do things. So, Dr. Wilson, if you could just join us quickly, and this is important for members to see. Spoken to Chair Beckets about this. I asked others if they wanted to author this, and then what we attempted to do, I asked nonpartisan staff in the House and, of course, the Department of Revenue to take their best shot in reading the actual proposal here and put it in bill form. Now, certainly this commission might change different things, but we're going to take the final minutes here to let Dr. Wilson show us to do these items, what do they cost, and if you were going to take the recommendation to expand the sales tax base and cigarette tax, you know, how big would you really have to expand this to get it to revenue neutrality, Dr. Wilson? And that's just been handed out, members, so if you can really direct us to the sheet here, Dr. Wilson, and help all members understand what we're looking at.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Wilson from the Department of Revenue. I think the easiest thing to do, given the time, is just to look at the third page of the memo. The rest is describes a few limitations. This is not an official revenue estimate in a normal form. We only tried to get some rough numbers for preliminary numbers for 2011, which is the year in which the bill says it should be balanced. If you look just down the list on the left-hand side, just concentrate on the left-hand side to begin with, you can see the cost of repealing the corporate income tax, or repealing the tax on that occupation tax. The 20% subtraction for S-Corp and partnership income is actually not an estimate that quite matches, but there's a comment in the memo about that probably overstates the cost compared to what's in the bill. But you can see the goodies at top, the tax reductions at top. The increases in revenue then, besides increase the cigarette tax, you'll see all the expansions in the sales tax that are included in the bill. All of these are limited to consumers only, primarily, except for maybe there's a question about the publication.
Just to interrupt so everyone gets that point now, this is following the commission's recommendation. There's no business-to-business tax in these numbers. These would be much bigger if there weren't. So this is attempting to follow the commission's recommendation and not have business-to-business sales tax. Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And you'll see at the very bottom, after all the lists, you'll see there are some adjustments. I started with the tax expenditure budget, so we took some forecast adjustments to reduce some of the numbers down based upon the reduction in consumption that we would expect to be there. And we also have a line for exempting inputs of the 8 newly taxed services. Their inputs, both direct inputs and capital equipment, are exempted from the sales tax when their services become taxable. The bottom line, if you look at the top, it says total revenue reductions of $956 million. Total revenue increases of a little over $1 billion. It's a little more than revenue neutral, and the bill directs us then to estimate what the reduction in the tax rate would be, and the 6.5% tax rate would go down to 6.387% if you made it revenue neutral. The added complication is we have a 3/8% constitutional constitutionally dedicated, that rate also can come down with a sales tax base broadening, and you'll see from the numbers here that that rate could come down to 0.311%, so there is an overall reduction in the sales tax rate to make this revenue neutral.
Okay, so and one more comment so members understand what we're looking at. If we wanted to implement the Governor's Tax Commission report, this sheet shows us roughly what we'd have to do to expand all these items in the sales tax and add cigarettes. But if Mr. Michael, who I'd asked to try to read the report and draft this, could tell us the assumptions on the food and heating and clothing, reading the report now, this was, you know, the low-income credit issue. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, just a couple of comments, I guess, on that point. As the Commission recommended not taxing those items unless you include a low-income credit, and in the short time that I had to do this, I didn't want to engage in the process of actually designing a credit, and so I just omitted those items. And now, in listening to the testimony, I realize that I may have misgauged some of the intentions of the Commission, because some of the report is very general. So, for example, on the R&D credit, I extended it to individuals at the 10% rate, made it refundable, but did not allow it to C-Corps because they're not paying the tax, and I was assuming he didn't want to make grants to them. But listening to the testimony, I'm not clear if that's really the intent or not. If not, that would raise the cost. There are a number of issues like that with the occupation tax. Since that's in lieu of the corporate tax, I had assumed that they wanted to repeal it and so forth. I think this exercise is useful, as Paul was going through it, just to show members essentially the list of exempt sales tax items that you would need to pick and choose from to come up with the revenue to offset the cost of these proposals. The other thing that I think it's useful to keep in mind, the corporate franchise tax is sort of a roller coaster ride. And right now we're not at the very bottom of the valley, but we're not at the top either. And I think we're actually somewhat a little bit away from maybe the median of sort of the trend line of corporate revenues over the time. And so that makes this task a little bit easier than it would be if we were, say, targeting FY 12 or 13. And so that's also something that's important for members to keep in mind as they go through this intellectual exercise of, you know, what are you willing to do a base expansion to pay for this kind of reform.
Mr. Beckett, I want to say to you, you know, very individually, and sorry, Blanchard, to you and all the people who serve with you, that, you know, you had a really rough task here, and I think people, you know, like to kick people who actually pay for things here, but you also know that that's how it's done. And you know, I think the governor knows my view that, you know, taking the spending items, the top part of the list, but not paying for them is problematic for the legislature. And I want to give you credit for finding a way to bring this in revenue neutral. It helps legislators understand if we're going to get to some of these proposals, and you know I've proposed cutting the corporate tax myself. We are going to have to pick either this list or some other revenue raisers out there in society to implement this. But I really do want to thank you. It's a rough year to even have the courage to bring something like this forward. And I want to remind members that you were never tasked with solving a deficit. In fact, there was no deficit when you were appointed. So, Commissioner Beckett, do you want to have the final word here in closing? We're a little over time, but we really thank you so very much for your work.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for the comments here. These are big and bold ideas. They certainly have to be paid for. We're not making specific recommendations on the list that have been prepared here. But we do believe that this will set Minnesota in a competitive position. It will create jobs, which we need to create jobs. It will create investment, and it will, in general, over the period of time, I believe, bring the additional revenues that we're looking for and put Minnesota back into the top tier where we need to be. Thank you, members.
So much. Thank you all. Thank you, Professor Spike, Senator Blanzer, and the rest of the folks who are here. We really appreciate it. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.